This drought has been the longest dry period of the Channel Country in outback Queensland since Bureau records on river data began in the 1970s. Even though recent rain has provided some relief, the region hasn't seen a major flood for more than 4 years. And for an area that used to be an inland sea in prehistoric times, that mass of water plays a critical role. It's a major flood that the country and the local industries rely on, as Lydia Burton reports.
Now, most people sort of talk about flood as being a disaster. Well, in the Channel Country, it's part of life, and I think it takes people a little bit to understand that it's not bad, it's good.
Windora Grazier and Mayor of the Barcoo Shire, Bruce Scott, has lived on Muthandella Station for the past 28 years. Muthandella relies on flooding from Thunder and Wichelow Creeks, which are both tributaries of the Cooper Creek.
Well, we hear plenty of stories of the cattle that come out of the Channel Country, and you know, they've talked about in folklore, and you know, plenty of old meatworks buyers and cattle buyers will tell you that, you know, these are some of the heaviest cattle you'll see when they come off a flood in these Channel Country rivers. So I don't think there's any argument that these rivers will put beef on cattle.
That sentiment is echoed throughout the Channel Country. James Kidd from Ordell Station near Windora also relies on flooding from the Cooper Creek.
Yeah, well, a good season without rain's probably better than a season here with rain. And the bigger the flood you get, well, the better it is. You probably triple your carrying capacity after a flood, or fatten three times what you usually would.
Why are floods good here?
Well, you just got to have them. Like, as much rain as you want, you can get on that black soil and it doesn't do what a flood will ever do.
Further south and west around Birdsville, rain is certainly useful. But again, it's a major flood in the Diamantina River that makes the world of difference for grazier Jeff Morton. The Diamantina runs straight through his property, Roseberth.
You've either got to have a flood or you've got to have a good rain event. These big places out here, they've got plenty of area, and we categorise the area into the two places. We have the flood country, obviously, and we have the downs country. And if you get a good downs country rain, like we've had lately, you don't necessarily need the flood. But a flood, a good flood, will give me a body of feed that will last me 2 years. So it's a good flood gives me a better long-term outlook.
Jeff Morton is also the mayor of the Diamantina Shire. He says it's not only agriculture that relies on the river systems, but also the communities.
More than anything, they rely on it for the tourist industry. A good flood gives them, you know, good bird life, flowers, greenery and all the rest of it.
For the Cooper, the summer of 2012 was the last major flood, and for the Diamantina and Georgina, it was 2011. According to Bruce Scott, who's been studying the Bureau of Meteorology's records, that's unprecedented.
You know, if you look back through that graph, you just see a year here and a year there where there's no flood. And when you see this four-year period, you start looking at that statistic and you think, well, we're in an uncharted area as far as these Channel Country rivers are. We're lucky there's been some rainfall, but that really heavy Channel Country, river country, you know, it's really needs a floodwater over it to give it that sort of boost of or flush of feed. And I guess that's the point of seeing this period of no flow or very little flow, of how much risk that places on those properties that rely on that flooding to have an agriculture and to have a business and to make money, but also how much the natural environment relies on those flushes through the river to stimulate the ecology of nature.
Back on the Diamantina, fourth generation grazier Jeff Morton says he's seen longer dry spells.
I wouldn't say it was the longest period without a flood, but it was certainly one of them. Back in the 60s we had periods that were the same, but to get a flood is a pretty big rain event. And like we've had rain in Birdsville or in the area in the last couple of weeks, and good rain, but it didn't go far up the Diamantina, so you have to get a rain over the whole area to sustain a flood.
What do you think it says about the climate, about the area, about the environment to have this extended period without a flood off the back of nearly a flood every year for some consecutive years?
Well, we had a flood in 2010 and 2011, that's true, we had two back-to-back. So the average of the Diamantina at Roseberth is floods every 4 years. So it's not an annual event by any means. So I guess on averages, we're probably still on average because they've had two in 6 years, really, when it all boils down to it. But I don't think it says anything for the climate. It's just it's happened before. The evidence on the ground is that they've had a lot bigger dry times than this one, historically, as in hundreds of years, perhaps, because you see where sandhills have built up across channels and made them, turned them into swamps because the water can't get through. So to put a sandhill across a river, a major creek, not a river, a major creek, it would be a drought of hundreds of years.
Thankfully, this drought hasn't lasted that long, but it's certainly having a big impact. Garth Tully has lived at Clunie Station near Bedouri since 1963.
We've got Lake Makati on Clunie here. It's about 70,000 acres, and you get a fair bit of flood out country on that. And our bullock paddock, well, it goes underwater. And between both of them, you know, we've had up to 5,000 head of cattle around the lake there. You know, they're putting on a kilo and a half a day while they're there, so it's pretty significant, really, when, you know, you get a decent sort of flood.
So what's it mean to not have those flood events?
Well, we've been destocked or half-stocked here at Clunie now for the last, more or less since about 2011 we started destocking, and we've only half-stocked since then, and lucky we've got pipelines that we run from the artesian bores. Otherwise we wouldn't have had any. It was only a couple of years ago where the whole river system from Marion Downs right down to Mont Kearney, there's only about two water holes in the whole system that had any water in it. So if we wouldn't have them pipelines, you wouldn't have had any cattle here.
The Channel Country covers a sixth of Australia's landscape, and the Georgina and Diamantina rivers, as well as the Cooper Creek, rely on rain in other areas. Bruce Scott says the current situation demonstrates just how widespread this drought has been and continues to be.
Yeah, the uniqueness of this environment is the fact that it relies on those flooding events from the high rainfall areas of around Blackall and Tambo up into the onto those western fall of the Carnarvon Ranges, right through, you know, the south of the Flinders Highway at Torrens Creek, and then right up into sort of south of Cloncurry and north and west of Mount Isa in the Barkly. So that high rainfall is how this ecosystem or ecology of these river systems, these inland draining systems, works. And that, I guess, is the point, that 4 years without a useful flood in these rivers goes to show how widespread this drought is and how widespread it is across that normally much more reliable country than what this lower channel country is.
So even though there has been some rain and even some flooding across the region over the past 4 years, Bruce Scott says he's still waiting for a useful flood, the last of which he saw in 2004.
Well, I guess a useful flood has got to be something that, you know, gets up around that sort of 5, 5.5 metres, 6 metres, you know, and higher, or even better. But the moderate flood for Cooper's Creek has started in recording around that 3 metres. Well, that's really only a run in the river. The water runs onto the Diamantina Development Road about 4.35 metres. So anything above that is, you know, starts to get into a stage where you're closing the roads. Well, we haven't even seen that in the last 4 years, where it's, you know, it might have run across the road a couple of times just from local rain, but just up and down, not, you know, wouldn't provide an event for making cattle feed in the channel country. I guess I should put it this way, is in this really marginal rainfall country, you've only got very small windows to make it happen. You know, we tick along, you know, through a 10-year cycle, and there's probably, you know, probably four awful years or say two really awful years, and there's probably three not so good years, and there's probably, you know, another 3 years that are what we may call average. But it's being in business when you get that window to have livestock production and be in a position to make some money for those lesser years is really important.
So with some winter rain falling in the areas that supply the Channel Country, and even a moderate flood in the Georgina, Diamantina and Cooper Creek recently, many, like Bruce Scott, are hopeful the trend can continue into the coming wet season.
Well, the old-timers tell you that no two floods are the same, and it's certainly that those flooding events are very unpredictable, but we need one badly for the river system, for the people that live, have an agriculture on it, and also the ecology that surrounds it as well.
Windora Grazier and Mayor of the Barku Shire, Bruce Scott, ending that report from Lydia Burton. And you can find some gorgeous Channel Country photos online at abc.net.au/rural. Well, after years of drought in the Australian bush, a change in the season has given natural cycles a kick start. As Sally Bryant reports, there's movement at the station.
Winter rains have lifted the mood across some of the more arid reaches of the Australian bush. Country that was parched a few months ago is now covered in a carpet of green sprinkled with wildflowers. Farmers and graziers are relishing the turn in the season. They're welcoming a break from the harsh drought conditions that had prevailed in recent years. And the livestock are not the only animals taking advantage of softer conditions. There are shy native species out there who are cashing in as well. Landholders like Meredith Thompson are starting to report some heightened activity.
We were driving from Bourke to Melbourne, and between Bourke and Cobar, there were like three little single file echidnas walking across the road. My husband says, oh, photo opportunity. So we chucked a Yui and took a photo of these echidnas. I've only seen one really in the flesh. People talk about them a fair bit, but yeah, I've never really seen them before. So it was very unusual for us.
Echidna are shy and solitary creatures. You can spend a lot of time in rural Australia without clapping eyes on one, let alone on a group of them. So seeing a caravan of them making their way across an outback road is pretty unusual, particularly given it's still officially winter, when any echidna worth his salt has hunkered down to avoid the cold weather. Zookeeper Danielle Woodhouse takes care of the echidna flock at Taronga Western Plains Zoo at Dubbo.
When the weather does get quite cool, they go into what's known as a hibernation or a torpor, and they'll slow themselves down and actually go underneath and sleep out most of the winter. Well, at the moment, it is kicking into their breeding time, so July to September is that, and that's when you're starting to see them pick up. They do obviously like the warmer weather, so when the sun starts shining and the rain goes away, that's definitely when they'll start coming out of ground. What they do is a trailing behaviour. So you have one female that'll come into season and release a pheromone, and then you can have up to 10 males actually following behind her. They'll follow her for about 10 hours per day, and this can happen for several days until she decides that she's going to stop, and first in line is generally who gets to breed. So they follow bumper to bumper, females obviously in front, and then the males are nose to bottom pretty much walking through. And yeah, you've got to be very careful if they're doing things like crossing roads, and you'll just see the little brigade walking across.
It's a curious concept, this echidna train. It's like a very much smaller and spikier version of a caravan of camels, making its way through the bush for hours on end. Danielle Woodhouse says the little creatures can be on the move for many hours, and things can get pretty crowded as numbers accumulate on the echidna train.
You generally probably have a 3 to 4. However, if it's a season when only one female's out and coming in, you'll get obviously a lot more males paying more attention to that particular female.
So is it like a process of elimination? You know, the guy at the head of the pack, he's the one who gets lucky, or is it a demonstration of strength or endurance if they can hang in there for 8 to 10 hours to be the last man standing? How does that all work?
We say it's the best kept secret at the moment. We are trying to exactly figure that out. If it is a physical strength thing, so that one that does last the longest, she goes, yeah, right, you're worthy of it. Or if it is just she waits until the male she likes the best comes into that first position and then she'll stop and wait for him. But at this point, we're not really sure.
Because nobody's managed to ask her.
That's exactly right.
Danielle Woodhouse is a keeper at Dubbo's Western Plains Zoo, ending that story from Sally Bryant. Well, the Climate Council says a growing trend of rural communities setting up their own wind and solar farms could generate thousands of jobs in regional Australia. The Council's latest report on the impact of climate change on rural areas says communities will continue to be affected by worsening extreme weather like bushfires and drought. But it points out that community-owned energy is one way to adapt. Here's our regional affairs reporter, Lucy Barber.
Watch out for that rabbit poo.
The sun is out at Goulburn in southern New South Wales.
This is where we're going to be. You can see over there there's a solar monitoring station.
Local Peter Fraser is keen to talk about his plans to help set up a $2.5 million community-owned solar farm in an unused paddock on the outskirts of town.
It'll be 1.2 megawatts. It'll have about 4,000 panels of solar voltaics. And it will generate enough electricity to power perhaps 300 to 400 homes in Goulburn.
What is a community-owned solar farm?
Community energy is a new idea in Australia. It's very common in Europe and in the US. But the community actually owns the generating plant. So in this case, the community will invest in purchasing the equipment, purchasing the panels. It'll pay for all of the connections to the electricity grid, and it will sell the electricity to people in this community who wish to purchase the electricity.
What drives an idea like this? What's the motivation behind it?
It's mostly to do with people's concern about renewable energy as being one of the steps that we have to take to do something about global warming. People in this community and in a lot of communities around Australia are pretty jack of the slow pace of reform when it comes to renewable energy. So they're actually taking things into their own hands rather than waiting around for governments to make decisions. So they're keen on it. And also there's a good return on investment if you put money into this kind of scheme.
The renewable energy sector faced a torrid time when Tony Abbott promised to dump the Australian Renewable Energy Agency and the Clean Energy Finance Corporation. When he took over as Prime Minister, Malcolm Turnbull reversed that decision and added $1 billion through a Clean Energy Innovation Fund. But the Climate Council's Professor Will Steffen says uncertainty lingers.
What we found in just doing a survey around the country is that there's enormous variation at the statewide level, and you can see that quite clearly in uptake of renewables, whether it be community or whether it be government-led. South Australia is a leading example. New South Wales at the other end is falling way behind what other states are doing. Queensland's sort of in the middle. Here in the ACT, even though we don't have much land, we're right up there with South Australia in terms of going renewable, funding projects in the southeastern grid. Some of them are within the ACT, the solar farms, but some of the wind farms are actually community-based wind farms in Victoria and South Australia. So state and local governments can do a lot in terms of helping communities get their renewable projects up and going.
One of the towns that you talk about in your report is Euralla in New South Wales, and it's interesting given that you're saying that New South Wales is dragging the chain in terms of supporting renewables projects, but Euralla is moving to, I think from memory, 100% renewables. What is it about a town like Euralla that really make it work?
Yeah, when you look at towns like Euralla and other examples around the country, it seems that some communities really get it together despite policies that may be operating at the federal level or even at the state level. And they seem to, I think, show leadership. You have to have some leaders in your community like in Euralla that can actually get on top of the issue, see the benefits for the community, do the hard work within the community to get support across political lines and say, look, forget about federal politics or whatever side you're on. This is good for our community. It's going to generate jobs. It's going to keep our electricity prices down. It's a project we can get behind. So, you know, there's a lot to be said for community-driven initiatives like Euralla, and renewables really lend themselves because they can operate at a number of scales. You don't need a massive power plant to do it.
In its latest report on the impact of climate change on rural areas, the Climate Council says there are currently 20 community energy projects up and running. But Tim Buckley from the Institute of Energy Economics and Financial Analysis questions whether they have the capacity to make a big difference.
Given Australia needs to commit to 5,000-6,000 megawatts of new renewables in the next 4 or 5 years to even give us a chance to deliver on our Paris commitment.
The Climate Council estimates that 28,000 jobs could be created if half of Australia's energy came from renewables by 2030, and that more than half of those would be in regional areas. Peter Fraser expects the Goulburn Solar Farm would employ 20 people during the construction phase, and he thinks the biggest benefit would be to local investors.
It's just like putting money in the bank, except here we'll be able to give around a 5% return interest rate on their investment. So it's somewhere where you can invest, you can make money, and you can do some good at the same time.
And that's Peter Fraser from Goulburn in southern New South Wales, ending regional affairs reporter Lucy Barber's story. Rural communities doing it for themselves, just what you'd expect. A big thanks to John Jacobs for technical production this week. It's been great to share those stories with you. I'm Edwina Farley. News and Saturday Extra are next.